Session number 9722.
Mr. Levine, Reel 2, you were saying about André Marty supposedly being paranoid.
Yeah, I was very apprehensive about undisciplined elements and suspicious people who had got to the base at Albacete to join the international brigades. Now then, coming back to our arrival in Paris, after seeing this Spanish representative of the Republican government who wouldn't accept us, we didn't know what to do. But in that same building was the offices of the Metal Workers Trade Union. And we went to see them and told them what had happened, that we'd come from London to join or Manchester, to join the international brigades, and the Spanish representative wouldn't have us because we had no credentials. So they believed our story, and they delegated one of their staff to meet us each evening, and they says, "Leave it with us. We'll sort of get in touch with London." And they put us up in some seedy hotel in that district of Paris. And we met this chap every night, you know, who was going to report to us what was taking place. And we had very little money, and we had very little to eat. And one evening, he used to take us around Paris and show us the, especially I remember the district where the great big market was, Les Halles, and he'd point out the different cafes and bistros that we won't go in there because that's a fascist haunt, you see. We'll go in here. And because at that time there was also a large fascist movement, the Croix du Feu, in France. And I remember one evening he said, "I'm going to give you a treat. We're going to this cafe. I'm going to order English tea for you." And we were really bloody starving by this time. And that tea came up, and I always remember it was like in a silver plated, you know, ware. It came in the teapot and so on. And the teapot had a little, at the spout, there was a little thing to catch the drips and so on. It was all very delicate and elegant. And after about 5 days, we were told we can go back to the office. And what had occurred, there was two new people had come out. One was a man named Wilson, a man much older than ourselves, who'd been in the First World War, and a Greek Cypriot, Tony Theodopoulos. He was the first Cypriot to go to Spain. And now the eight of us now were told to go to the Gare Austerlitz and to meet a man who would, he was described to us where he would stand on the concourse, and he would give us tickets to go to Spain to get to Perpignan. And we did that. And now then, when we finally got to Albacete and paraded in the bullring before André Marty, and there was hundreds now circling that bullring, they were pouring into Spain, different nationalities. And he called out Marty. He stood in the center, and you all around the perimeter of the bullring, and he would call out for his different specializations of military ability, who were machine gunners, who were artillery, who were communication people, infantrymen, and so on. Now, out of our eight, only Wilson stepped forward, and he had been in the artillery in the First World War. He was taken away to join an artillery unit. I never saw him again. I don't know what happened to him. I tried to check. I don't know what happened to him. And we seven were about the only ones in that assembly, because most of these people came from the European countries, had conscript training or had been in the First World War. And we seven, Marty came over to us and he says, "You go and join the French art, where you'll be infantrymen, you see." And we stayed in Albacete several days. I remember I passed my 29th birthday in the caserne, that's the French term, I think, for a barracks, in the cuartel, in the Spanish term, I think it is called. And there was just this half dozen of us, and the Frenchmen, all the rest were French or Belgiques or one or two other nationalities, And they gave us all the details, like working in the kitchen, you know, and they gave me a large sack of potatoes and told me to peel it. And I was already suffering from sort of diarrhea or something like that. I'd been in Spain now about a week or so. And that was my 29th birthday, peeling a full sack of potatoes and feeling very ill.
Did the French discriminate against the British in that respect?
I think they did. I don't want to be chauvinistic about this, but I think they did, because we were only just a few Englishmen, and it was language difficulty, and it was just easy to say, well, you go and sweep up, or you go and do that, etc., etc. Because later on, when we got to Madrigueras, they put my friend Bill Benson and myself on guard at the commandant's house, and we were there for two nights running through the night, being on guard. So maybe we were slightly discriminated against.
So what happened to you next?
By this time that we were in Madrigueras, lots of men from the UK were now arriving. Some from Manchester, many from Glasgow and London, and a few Welshmen, just about three or four, I think, at that time. And in those days, we elected our own commanders, and we had a meeting with the British now. We were our, something like 100 people were there in this Madrigueras place. And I think by this time, the French had moved. No, they hadn't moved out. Couldn't have done. And because I'd been on guard at the commandant's house. But we elected a man who stood out as a military figure. That was George Nathan, who had come to Spain carrying his officer's uniform from the First World War. And he was elected as our leader.
Who elected him, exactly?
We had a meeting to elect a leader, and somebody spoke in favour of someone, and someone spoke in favour of someone else, and then this man had a military bearing, a nice, neat little black moustache, a little above medium height, rather broad-shouldered, and there was a man there who looked a real tough character. And he says, I know George. He says, I've hoboed across America with him. You know, in the 20s, something like that. And I know he's a good guy. But it appeared that he did do that. George Nathan at one time had hoboed across America. And he said he'd been an officer in the First World War. So that was okay. And he was accepted as the officer. But later on, after he had commanded us at La Pera, where we were now what was called the First English Company, and we were now 145 strong who went to that part of Andalusia in Cordova province. And then from there, we were rushed, after being in action there, we were rushed from there to northwest Madrid in January the 10th, to halt an attack by the Franco forces, who had been halted on their frontal attack on Madrid and now swung round to the Guadarrama Mountains in the northwest to, I believe, to cut off the water supply to Madrid that came from that part. And Nathan had been our commander again. And we returned from those two actions, from the two fronts, 45 strong. I remember that very clearly. And now we returned to Madrigueras, because by that time there were several hundred men from the UK in Madrigueras training, and a British battalion was being formed. So naturally, the remnants of the 145, which was only 45 later on after the two actions, some had deserted, some had, a number had been killed, of course, and a number had been wounded. And some were sick.
Could we go over this ground that you've gone over very quickly there? Could we go over it in detail? First of all, could I ask you a bit more about Nathan? I think that you heard about an incident later in which he had some kind of trial by Irish elements.
Yes. I have dealt with that trial in my booklet, and I think I've written about it elsewhere. Now, when Nathan got back from these two fronts to Madrigueras in January, late January 1937, more Irishmen had come out. We'd had Irishmen with us in the two fronts, and there's still one knocking around in London, who was at La Pera, named Joe Monks. Now, he was recognised. Most of the Irishmen at that time were members of the IRA who had come to Spain. That is the Marxist wing, if you like, of the, what was the Irish Republican Army, under the influence or the leadership of a man named Frank Ryan, who was the editor of the Republican paper and Poblacht in Dublin. Now, it was alleged amongst these Irishmen that Nathan had been in the Black and Tans, in the auxiliary force in the Crown Forces in Ireland in 1921, and he was a marked man because it was alleged that he had shot the mayor of Limerick and had also shot the deputy mayor of Limerick, because there was these actions taking place in the south of Spain, these assassinations, you see.
South of Ireland.
And Southern Ireland. And they put him on trial, a secret trial, as to what to do with him. Now, I got to know about this trial. I believe I was the only non-Irishman who got to know about it, because one of the participants in that trial was Jim Prendergast, who was a friend of mine, had been at La Pera and Las Rosas. And when the trial was over, he says, "Look, Morris, it's a secret trial. We're not supposed to tell anyone." But he says, "I know you." He says, "I know you think a lot of Nathan, because he was such an outstanding commander, as I'll tell you." And he told me that story, which I have repeated, which I believe to be true, that he had carried out. Now, his defence at this trial was that he was a member of the Crown Forces. He was an officer, and he'd been detailed to do this job, and he'd gone out with another man. This has been researched since, and there was a long article in New Statesman and Nation in 1961 dealing with this, I believe. And I am of the opinion that this really occurred. Now, Nathan's defence was, "Look," he says, "I've come to Spain to fight fascism. I'm not denying what I did, because I was instructed to do so as a member of the Crown Forces. But," he says, "I've come to Spain to fight fascism because I'm a Jew," and though he'd never bothered with the Jewish community, you know, it was an eye-opener for them to hear he was a Jew, you know, in the position he was in, and so on. And he says, "If you want to shoot me," he says, "go ahead." But he says, "But I've come here." But he had such a splendid record as commander that they agreed to allow him his freedom.
What had Prendergast thought about this trial? What was his feelings? What were his feelings about it?
That I couldn't say. He just told me what had taken place. I think he was favourable to Nathan because he'd been in action, two actions with him, and of course he was influenced by this man's courage and his demeanour under fire and so on.
Did you actually speak to Nathan yourself?
I spoke to Nathan many times, but I did speak about this trial, because it was supposed to be secret. I couldn't discuss it with him.
What type of things would you talk to him about?
Oh, nothing very much, except he'd come along the front, you know, and we were learning to be soldiers in action, because I'd never fired a gun before going to the front, knew nothing at all about it. And he'd say, "Hey, laddie, I remember one shell coming over at Las Rosas de Madrid, and there's about eight of us on a little ridge, and we'd be told to stay there. And a shell fell amongst us, and three were killed immediately. A couple were wounded, and then Nathan came along to see what was going on. We're outside this village, and he saw the carnage there, And he says, "Look, laddies," he used to call you a laddie. He says, "Look, laddies," he says, "just go down there." It was a slight decline, but we should have been in the first, you know, it would have been all right. But he told us to stay there, and we stayed there, you see, because we trusted him implicitly. And he says, "Look, laddies, go down there." So, I mean, apart from just casual conversation, I never had much contact with him. But there is a man in Liverpool who was his chauffeur, his driver, named Galloway, whom I tried to get to Manchester just a couple of weeks ago. We had a commemoration of the Harama took place in Manchester, February the 14th. But he was unable. I've never met him, but I believe he's got a lot of stories to tell about Nathan.
So Nathan never told you anything about his past?
No.
Now, can you tell me about when you were in Andalusia, what the work you did with personally with the International Brigade was there? Can you describe it in detail?
You mean in the fighting and all that business?
Yes.
Well, there was a small group of us, I don't know how many, maybe 6 or 10. When we got to that front, we were detailed to assist the French machine gunners to carry the machine gun, which was the Maxim gun, a heavy gun from the First World War, a Russian gun, I believe, called a Maxim, which had a detachable front shield, heavy metal wheels and so on, which you split. And I remember dragging this heavy. And I was allocated to a French machine gun team. There might have been about 3 or 4 on the team.
What was your job in the team?
My job? I hadn't been trained to do anything. I was like, right, you carry this. And it was that sort of situation. And we got into the front at nightfall on the top of a hill. And I had a rifle. I'd never fired a rifle before in my life. And I could see flashes of fire from the hill in front of us. But I didn't know what to do. I mean, I was waiting for orders, you know, instructions. And it's dark, and the machine gun team was setting up the gun, putting it together and so on. And then I felt a dig in my ribs. It was the commander of the machine gun company, Captain Alexandra. And he said to me something in French. I got the gist of it. If I didn't fire, he'd shoot me. You know, he thought I was afraid, but I wasn't afraid because I couldn't see anybody to be afraid of. I only saw flashes of fire. And I was dying to shoot this gun, to fire the gun, to see what it was like. You know, the reaction and that sort of thing. So I was with that team.
So you opened fire, did you?
I opened fire, yes. I fired at the other light, at the other fire, where I saw the flashes of fire, rifle fire from a little distance away.
Did it cease?
Pardon?
Did the firing cease?
I can't remember. All I knew that after a while everything died down, you see. And the next morning, or maybe 2 days later, I can't actually remember, but I was taken away from the French machine gun team and one or two others who were in separate French machine gun teams and told to join the rest of the British. See, and then I rejoined the British. It might have been the second or the third day of the action. I can't remember.
Where was this place?
This place was outside a village called Lopera, L-O-P-E-R-A, which was on the road to Cordova itself.
And do you know the date, approximately?
Yes. I believe we went into action on Christmas Day. There's some confusion about this. Some say it was the 28th, but I believe it was Christmas Day that we arrived in Lopera, in Andújar. That was the rail station we detrained at, and from there we went to the front. I believe we got there on Christmas Eve and went into action on Christmas Day, the following day.
Can you remember who your English companions were?
Yes, of course. There was the five who went out with me, 6 in all. And then I came across a man from Oldham named Harry Rawson. Now, he was a man, an older man who'd been in the First World War and I believe got a decoration, a DCM in the First World War, who was a communist leader in Oldham. And he was the first one to go from Oldham. And I can always remember seeing that man after the action had died down at Lopera when I'd rejoined the British. And he had, as a man, he had two names. He tried to go out something. He used two names. He used a nom de guerre named Harry Rawson or Harry Heap. One of those two names was his real one. And I remember him lying with his back against an olive tree. We were now come back from some sort of a skirmish in action and were resting. And he looked deathly pale. He had been out of work, I believe, for about 4 or 5 years that time, and probably suffering from malnutrition. And he got killed in an action the following day or something like that. It was Harry Rawson. I remember him very clearly. About my immediate comrades from Manchester, I can remember those who went out with, and there was two or three from the Colliers district of Manchester. That's North Manchester, another. And then, of course, I was friendly with other people. I got to know this, for somehow or other, we got together, this chap, Sidney Quinn, from Glasgow, who had been in the British Army, stationed at Aden, and he'd come to Spain, and he was a great guy. And the one or two Londoners I got to know, who were also in the French machine gun team, one named Knight, and the other fellow name was George Rowe, and several more as I got to know.
Now, after you were moved from the French machine gun team, you were put into what unit?
Joined the remainder of the British. Under Nathan.
Can you describe what happened?
Well, yes. We were then still involved in battle, of course. And there'd been a terrible mix-up during these early battles that they said the French machine gunners were firing us or something like that. And the commander of the battalion, called the Marseillais Battalion, 12th Battalion Marseillais of the 14th Infantry Brigade, was a man called Colonel de La Salle, who had been a French regular army officer. And he was arrested on suspicion of being a spy and that sort of thing. And I was asked, along with Sid Quinn, I was approached by General Walter, who was a very, very well-known figure in the Spanish Civil War. His Polish name, I can't pronounce, Wyszyński or something, but he was known as General Walter, a man who had fought in the Red Army during the Civil War, a Pole, and who incidentally had a terrific career. He went right to the war in Spain, and in the Second World War, he led a Polish division from Russia right to the gates of Berlin. And when the Second World War was over, he was appointed as the Minister of Defence in the first Polish government in Warsaw. And in 1946 or 47, he was assassinated, ambushed by some dissident group in Poland, and he was killed. That was General Walter, of whom Stalin characterised, he was only a slim man, shortish slim man, as Walter is, well, he didn't call him Walter, but he was characterised as that bad skin and bones or something. But he was a very nice fellow, very cordial and affectionate towards the British for some reason. Now, he came along to this olive grove where we were resting one evening, along with a man who was the a commissar, like a base commissar, named Peter Carrigan, who was one of the leaders of the Communist Party in England, and along with two Polish soldiers who were his escort. And they came up, and Quinn and I were resting by an olive tree, and we seemed to be the first of them they approached to, and they asked us, would we go back with them and guard a prisoner, they said. They didn't know who the prisoner was, didn't tell us. And I looked at these two blokes, and they looked Jewish to me, these two Polish soldiers. I thought they were Jewish. Now, I'm Jewish, and I had a bit of Yiddish, you know, so I made out I couldn't understand the broad Scots accent of, Glaswegian accent of Kerrigan. I wanted to chat to these two blokes. So I spoke to them in my limited Yiddish, and they were Jews, and they spoke to me in Yiddish, and they told me the whole story, that we're going back to to guard the commander of the battalion.
What did they? Can you give more details about what they said?
No, except they took us to an abandoned farmhouse where people were already guarding the La Salle. And they left and we took over for the night. And we were told not to sleep. We're in this bedroom, sleeping on the floor. I mean, bedroom, there's no bed. And not to sleep and to guard de La Salle. Now, I had association with de La Salle in Madrigueras. He put me in prison in It's another story which he's told in this booklet of mine. And I had no animosity to de La Salle because he was quite right in sending me to prison because it was through a breach of discipline on my behalf. See? And what his name got down to sleep in his long johns and his vest, you know, and he had his great coat over him. And I said to Sid, look, it's no both of us keeping awake. I says, one will have a little nap and then wake the other up and so on. And the following morning, they called for us with a camion, a little truck, and took us to another large farmhouse somewhere, which must have been the divisional headquarters of this brigade or something like that, or brigade headquarters, which was... Where it was, I can't tell you. And we delivered, Colonel de La Salle, and I met Nathan there, and also a man named Pete Jansen, who was a Dutchman with our British company. And he was the interpreter at his, what do you call it? Now then, we stayed there. We didn't see any of the other officers there. We hung around this building and kept out of the open because there was that fascist aviation coming over, you know, you didn't want to see anybody walking about the grounds, and we kept under cover. And we learnt later on, I think Jansen told us, I don't believe Nathan told us, he was court-martialed and he was shot. No, he was shot, and there were Russian officers there, I believe, and I think... They carried out the penalty.
What did you
say? He was accused. He admitted at his trial. This is what we got from the interpreter. I see no reason why it was untruthful. He admitted that he had served in Bucharest as the military attaché to the French mission, French legation there, or embassy, or what. And he was... Part of his duties were espionage, military espionage against the Soviet Union. But he said he'd come to Spain because he was an anti-fascist and he'd been in the French army as a regular army officer. And it was alleged he was a fascist, a spy, and he was accused of cowardice. There was a big mix-up there at the front. I can't go into all the details of it because I don't know it, except it was said that the French machine gunners were firing at the British unit. You know, there was something wrong had taken place. But...